This is Wake Up Call.
Another kind of daytime radio program.
On the SportsMap Radio Network.
All right. Let's do this.
Alongside Ron Culver, here's Tony D.
All right, good morning and a good Monday to you. And it's not just any Monday. We're going to start NFL previews this week. Because, yeah, we're going to do a division every single week all the way up until the week the NFL season will kick off. So today we're going to start with the NFC East. We're going to get that underway today. But we do have some things to discuss from the weekend. Now, again, they may not be the biggest things that are going on, but I found them really interesting. I was watching Sunday the Wimbledon final and Novak Djokovic winning. And if you know Novak Djokovic's story, he was unvaccinated and didn't play in a couple of events in Australia and whatnot. But he went to Wimbledon, where he has won six times, and he took on Nick Kyrgios, who did not have to play Rafael Nadal, who pulled out. Now, for Kyrgios, it was in his first Grand Slam final, where for Novak Djokovic, he was looking for Grand Slam championship number 21, having been in 32 of them. And I feel like tennis, at least for me, is kind of, it hasn't, the level of importance, or not importance, that's probably wrong. My level of interest has sort of waned over the last couple of years. It's been dominated by three individuals, and while that might look back as, say, one of the best, I sort of miss a different time for that tournament. But I kind of got it back a little bit on Sunday watching Nick Kyrgios, who, again, had never been on that stage before. He's kind of a big... temperament guy, and going up against sort of the stoic Novak Djokovic, who was looking for yet another mark in history. So we'll talk about that coming up a little bit. We got the All-Star game coming up in Los Angeles, and the starters and the reserves and the pitchers were released. And like anything else, you get the snubs and the people who go, oh, you know what? This person should have made it. He didn't make it. Oh my God, the world is falling apart. We've got that for you. And then the latest on Brittany Griner, we kind of touched on it a little bit last week, but there's a little bit more to this story and what she was doing over there to begin with. We have a real problem sometimes in this country not getting to the real reason or the truth. We look at things through a certain lens, and we're not immune to it in sports, where sports can be, there's a lot of opinion in sports, but there's also a lot of fact, right? The game is in and of itself the game. But we sometimes take stories like this and run with a narrative that best suits a political angle. And that's exactly what's going on. So we're going to separate a little fact from fiction on that as well. All right, but coming up, thoughts on the Wimbledon final, and we'll get to that coming up next.
You're listening to Wake Up Call on the SportsMap Radio Network. Alongside Ron Culver, here's Tony D.
All right, good Monday to you. Thanks for joining us as we continue. It's Wake Up Call on SportsMap Radio, on Twitter, at Tony D Radio, at Ron Culver. That is Ron with two N's. All right, did you watch a Wimbledon final yesterday? What a fantastic run for Novak Djokovic yesterday. Our man Joker picks up number 21.
Still can't stand him.
I know, but...
Is it about him?
I don't know. I don't know. I'm okay with him. I like him. I know he got a lot of flack for the vaccination thing.
But I didn't like him before that.
Nick Kyrgios, though, is got a massive temper. He's so fun.
Yeah, he is.
He is so fun because he is a throwback to the McEnroe-Connors day. I love that because I'm a fan of that. I know some people are like, ugh. But to me, I like a guy who wears his heart out like that. He had He had two things in that match yesterday. He wanted a woman thrown out who was disrupting him during serve and stuff. Said he told the judge she had like 700 drinks. It's like she's the one with 700 drinks. But the woman said she only had a couple. But nevertheless, she got removed. But then he was yelling at his box. He was yelling at his coaches and the people supporting him because they weren't enthusiastic enough, or they weren't giving him enough energy, or whatever it was. He had no problems. I mean, in front of on center court, in front of all those people, thousands and thousands of people, and then millions and millions and millions around the world watching. He had no problem. Like, he has no problem just yelling, screaming, arguing, whatever, and making a scene. He has no problems with that. Doesn't care how he looks. Doesn't mind. But I found it interesting because Kyrgios took the first set, and then Djokovic won sets 2, 3, and 4, and won 4 in a tiebreaker, one that he really dominated, and then took, you know, obviously the Wimbledon title, his 7th and the 21st Grand Slam title of his career. But one of the McEnroes, because both were on the broadcast yesterday with Chris Fowler, one of the McEnroes said something really interesting, and that he said Kyrgios has a fear of losing. But he didn't use that phrase like we tend to use that phrase, because when we tend to use that phrase to describe, let's say, Aaron Rodgers or Tom Brady or somebody who's really competitive and just doesn't like to lose, we use it in that kind of context, right? We like, you know, Tom Brady has a fear of losing, because what it implies is that he's a winner, right? And he does whatever it takes to win, and he only cares about winning, and sort of that becomes like a badge of honor. But they didn't use that phrase to describe Kyrgios that way. They used it to describe that feeling that one has when they're on a big stage like that. And for Kyrgios, it was his first ever Grand Slam final, whereas they were describing him as a person that feared looking bad at that stage. Like, I can't lose this. I don't want to lose this. If I lose this, I'll look awful doing it. I don't want to look bad doing it. So it was a different phrasing of fear of losing than we kind of tend to use it with the athletes that we describe, like Steph Curry or Tom Brady or LeBron or anybody else that like goes all out to try to win games. Kyrgios played well. I mean, at one point he was gathering a lot of momentum, but it was his breakdown, his upset all the time about little things, things that were getting under his skin, things that he was getting bothered with, that showed another aspect, that the stage was very, very large. He's going to go back. He's too talented of a player not to be on that stage again. But you could sense the moment was getting to him a little bit. And for Djokovic, who'd been to like 32 Grand Slam finals in his career, was very calm, collected, never really let momentum shift all that much, and never felt, you know, any burden. Just let the game come to him, and let the match come to him. And he was able to, you know, again, get rid of that first set loss and then go on to win 3 in a row. And I thought that was very interesting the way they described Kyrgios, because we talk a lot about these athletes, especially these individual sports. And you see it in golf too, where there have been golfers who have been competitive in majors, but can't quite cross the finish line. And they get a little tight and they get a little tense and they worry about losing rather than concerning themselves with winning. And again, because that phrase is often used with guys who we describe as having a winning mentality, we don't think about Tom Brady in those Super Bowls or in those playoff losses with a fear of losing, meaning a fear of looking bad or a fear of failing. They just go out there, and if they lose, they lose, but they don't fear not living up to the moment. Kyrgios looked like a player at times failing to live up to the moment, or fearing that he wasn't living up to the moment. And that was a different mentality than we see other athletes. Djokovic didn't have that. Djokovic didn't have that sort of fear that he would be beaten. He just let the match come to him and just did everything he could to try to win it. And I think if he had lost it, I think he still would have said, I may have let some get away, but in the end, I was beaten today. I don't think Kyrgios wanted to admit that he was beaten until the very end, when he just kind of graciously said, Djokovic, you know, because he even said afterwards, he's like, Djokovic didn't do anything spectacular that I found surprising. He just does what he normally does. He returns the serves really well, but he played a lot cooler, played a much cooler game than I did, you know, and that's kind of the way he described the match. So, but Kyrgios is way too talented, and whatever reason, and this is like the stuffiness of the Wimbledon court, for whatever reason, I felt like, because I was really interested in the post-match commentary, I really wanted to hear both players speak. They've jarred each other on social media and whatnot, giving the appearance that they're not too friendly. And Kyrgios wears his heart out. He's got a temper. He's slammed balls into the crowd. He's yelled at the ball, boys and girls. He's yelled at umpires. He's been visibly upset at his coach and his team. Like I said, he's had somebody kicked out. And yet the crowd loved him. The crowd really, really loved him. They really appreciated that. And I don't know where that comes from, because it's a stuffy crowd. Let's be honest. It's the All England Club, for crying out loud. I mean, it's in front of royalty. It's in front of very important VIPs in the state, in the government, if you will. But yet he got a huge ovation. He got a very warm embrace from that crowd. He even wore a red hat, which you're not supposed to do. It's all white, and he broke that rule, for his hat. And yet the fans and the crowd embraced him. He said something. I will tell you right now, if Kyrgios was an American tennis player, if he was an American tennis player and said this, there would be a lot more people asking, why would you say something like this? Kyrgios was asked, but the question was that was delivered to him was, how did it feel? Is your first Grand Slam final, did it make you hungry for more? And he kind of joked and said, no, that was a lot of tennis. You know, he played a lot of tennis, but he really didn't, because he didn't play a semifinal match. Like, he got a free walk to the final because Rafael Nadal did not make it. So he got a bigger break than Djokovic did. But he also sort of, when he kind of stopped joking about that, he said, I don't know if I'll ever get here again. And it was like an admission that his thought isn't, oh, I'll be back. His thought was, I have no idea if I'm capable of being back. And it was, I almost had a sympathetic twinge to it for me. I was like, I don't know if he believes that he's very, very capable. He's 27 years old. The three guys that have dominated tennis are hitting an age where they'll be leaving the sport pretty soon. Their time is coming. And there's a new group that's on their way up, and he's one of them. And I can't believe he does not think that he'll be back on this stage at some point. Now, he may have been, hey, I'm 27. I've been a pro a long time. Usually get to these things when you're 19, 20, 21. I didn't. I usually get into these things at a very young age, and then you get, I've been doing this for a while, and I'm just now starting to break through. Maybe that's the case. Djokovic being polite, but I also think very sincere, when it was his turn to the microphone, he simply said, you will be back. You will be back here. You're too good of a player not to be here. And then they kind of had a joking back and forth about, you know, going to dinner and, you know, starting a bromance. And it was kind of fun. But I tell you, if imagine an American tennis player had said that, how many people in this country would be like, wait a minute, what's happening? How can you have that sort of defeatism about you already? But at least he was honest. And I will say that honesty was refreshing. It wasn't a cliched answer. I mean, it was a cliched question. I mean, what do you think he's going to say, right? It's a simple question. Oh, does it make you hungry for more? Okay. No. Like, of course the answer is yes. But he was honest enough with his answer to say, I don't know if I'm going to see this again. I don't know. Like, am I going to be, I don't know. And Djokovic had to sort of tell him it. Yeah. No, you'll be here. You'll be here again. Too talented. Big serve. So anyway, that was Wimbledon from Sunday. It was a men's finals. Djokovic wins again. Boy, it's really fascinating. Somebody was pointing out that the last 18 Wimbledons, nearly 20 years on the men's side, that's the last time, 18 years ago, is the last time we had a person win Wimbledon as a first-time major winner. Everybody else, I mean, it's filled with Federers and the Nadals and Djokovic's, but it's, you know, that's how we don't have a group yet that's taking. Remember we were joking about this last week with the hot dog eating contest, and we were kind of joking around about, hey, why hasn't anybody been able to step up and challenge this guy, right? It was kind of a joke, like Joey's eating 70 hot dogs and the next one is 50. Like, it's not even in the same ballpark. That's kind of the way, and on a serious side, that's kind of the way it is in men's tennis. It's like there's three guys and
they're always in the final.
They're always in the finals. They're always there. And every now and then you get somebody else, but for the most part, you don't.
Get those three.
You get those three, and every now and then somebody else pops up. But other than that, it's those three.
Kind of reminds me of AFC quarterbacks.
right.
For the Super Bowl, where there was literally three guys and Joe Flacco.
That's exactly right. Three guys. So, yeah, so every now and then you can find somebody outside of the big three that is one, but it's not a lot. And I don't know if that helps the sport, hurts the sport, because it makes the sport more interesting when you have a dominating presence of a group of athletes. But at the same time, you lose a little bit. Like, again, going back to Nick Kyrgios, he probably didn't think he would ever get to a final because he's probably in the same mentality of, I try my heart out here and I can't beat these guys.
Yeah.
I run into one of them eventually before I get to this point. And I think that's kind
and
of.
And he would have. I mean, honestly.
He would have ran into Nadal. Right?
We were trying to figure it out last week at what a 7-millimeter abdominal tear feels
right.
like.
No kidding.
Obviously enough to keep you out of a final.
Right.
Let's look at it. I mean, good chance Nadal wins that game, and it's Nadal and Djokovic again.
Yeah, exactly. So, all right. On Twitter, at Tony D Radio, at Ron Culver. That's Ron with two N's. Coming up, I want to give a quick update on the Brittany Griner situation. We've been following that story. And then we'll also get into the Major League Baseball All-Star Game, which will be at Dodger Stadium coming up this year as we continue with Hour 1 as you're rolling along on Wake Up Call.
This is Wake Up Call on the SportsMap Radio Network. Alongside Ron Culver, here's Tony D.
All right, so I did look it up when we were talking about the men's singles, how there just really hasn't been anybody besides Nadal, Djokovic, and Roger Federer. And sure enough, that is absolutely correct. Go back to 2004, which is a million years ago, by the way. I mean, well, what is that, 18 years ago?
Yeah.
Right, so at the Australian Open, Marat Safin won in 2005. Stan Wawrinka won in 2014. Those are the only two outside the big three that have won the Australian Open since 2004. There has only been two guys outside of Federer, Nadal, and Djokovic who have won the Australian Open since 2004. The French Open is even more. Well, there's three in the French Open. In 2004, Gaston Gardiot, he won the French Open in 2004, but it's all Nadal and Federer, Djokovic until you get to 2015 with Stan Wawrinka. That's two. That's two in the 18 years that has been conducted. So that's what, like 19 tournaments? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 19, yeah. And then in Wimbledon, a little bit more, but not that much. Andy Murray has two Wimbledon championships, and that's it. Two guys, Novak, Federer, Andy Murray, Novak, Nadal, and Federer have won all the Wimbledon since 2004. U.S. Open, there's Juan Martín del Porto, there is Andy Murray, there's Marin Cilic, and Stan Wawrinka, Dominic Thiem, and Daniel Medvedev. So there's been a different variety of U.S. Open champions. But that's it. Those there has not been very many people outside of those big three that have won in the last 18 years. So that, I mean, it's really wild. I mean, it's just to look at it, look at the graph. It's insane. So there you go. All right. So the quick latest on Brittany Griner, and we've been following this story. So she pleaded guilty, and it helps in a prisoner exchange. She told the judge last week she did not mean to pack the vape pen with the cannabis oil, did it in a hurry, did not mean to do it. Over there, you can be, even if you're acquitted, acquittals can be reversed, but you don't want to plead not guilty if the evidence is overwhelming. You're likely to be more punished. And she, again, it allows for a possible prisoner exchange. Bill Richardson, the former governor of New Mexico, is going to go over there to try to negotiate a prisoner exchange. I think that there in the sports world, there needs to be a better understanding of what exactly is going on here, because I think too many people are making too many quick statements. Look, I get it. We're in a fun culture right now of arguing with each other over every little thing politically. And when I say fun, I do mean it sarcastically, because sometimes it's not fun. We're having real debates and real arguments over everything. And we hear it all the time. We're in a culture of really disliking anybody that disagrees with our view. But the reality of it is this is not part of any sort. Like, you cannot look at what's going on with her in Russia through the lens of what you find, what you like or dislike about the way the United States is right now. To hear the coach, the Phoenix Mercury coach, to hear her say, you know, that this is not a, this is about misogyny and this is about how women are treated and this, I don't necessarily think that's the case. I have no idea what they're thinking over there, but that's not here. What's going on there is different. And you got to be a little bit more patient. They're angry at Joe Biden and the administration because they can't just get her out. Well, you can't just pick up the phone and just get her out. That's not how it works. And I know she made the comment, like, if it was LeBron James, he'd be out right now. Maybe. I don't know. Maybe. I know what she's saying, and I get her point. And there's probably good, probably truth to that. But it isn't as simple as them just going, you know, it's just a silly woman's basketball player. I'm not going to be bothered by picking up the phone and calling. You've got to act with a lot of diplomacy in this kind of situation. But the one other thing I will tell you that drove me crazy this weekend, Ron, is when people were saying, well, you know, she has to go over there. She doesn't make any money here in the United States playing basketball. She's forced to go overseas to make a living. Brittany Griner makes $250,000 playing women's basketball. That's not millions of dollars like professional athletes make, but it's a lot of money in this country. It's way more than the average salary in the United States. The WNBA season is 3 months long. There's plenty of opportunity for her to make endorsement money as well. She goes overseas to play in Russia. Do you know why? Because in Russia, women's basketball players become very, very wealthy because there's a lot of shady people that own basketball teams in all sports in Russia. They use it for money laundering. That's been Kate Fagan did a great in-depth report on this for ESPN the magazine. She actually went there to see. She flew out there years ago to do this story to see how popular women's basketball was because Diana Taurasi and Sue Bird, a couple of others, were making a lot of money over there. And she's like, is that culture accepting women's basketball better than we are in the United States? And she found empty arenas, no tickets were being sold, nobody cared, no media coverage, nothing. And yet there was a ton of money that were given to these women to come over there and play. And she did a little digging, and it was clear that there was some money laundering that was going on based on her investigations. She went over there to capitalize on making money. She wasn't forced to because she couldn't feed her family. She couldn't because the WNBA doesn't pay enough to live on. She gets paid a good amount of money, not great in terms of athletes in this country, and maybe it could be better. I don't know, but the WNBA needs a better economic structure. But she went over there to capitalize on making money. Many people do it all over the world. Many people leave all sorts of jobs, contractor jobs, engineering jobs, all sorts of jobs to take overseas. Some do, some don't. I have a friend of mine who was offered a job in Saudi Arabia. He turned it down years and years ago. He didn't want to move there. But he was offered a lot of money to go over there and work in engineering. Same thing with a lot of professions. A lot of companies around the world go to the poach talented people from the United States to work there. Women basketball players are no different. Men's basketball players are no different. When I was in minor league basketball for 2 years, we thought we would be able to keep people at home. Oh, they'll love to be at home. Family gets to see them play, more familiar surroundings, more familiar food, familiar accommodations, all of those kind of things. We were wrong. As soon as these guys would get a call from Portugal, they'd be on a plane. They'd quit all the time. Oh, I'm going to Brazil. Oh, I'm going to Peru. Oh, I'm going to Mexico. Oh, I'm going to Japan. Wherever it was, it didn't matter. Spain, France, Germany, they were on the next flight. Their agent got them on the next flight because they can make a lot of money. They weren't making six figures in our league, but they could make six figures shooting ball in Greece. WNBA players are no different. So let's get rid of the narrative, like if only she got paid a little bit more money. They just paid her a halfway decent wage. She made a good living for a three-month league that doesn't make any money, that loses money every single year. She went over there because she can make more money, like any of us. And so I really, really had a problem with the narrative this week. Like, somehow we as a society are at fault for Brittany Griner being detained in Russia because if only she could make LeBron James money being the best player in the WNBA, she wouldn't have to go over there. This is not true. All right, it's Wake Up Call Sports Map Radio on Twitter @TonyDRadio @RonCulver. That's Ron with two N's. We continue.
Wake Up Call with Tony D and Ron Culver continues now on the Sports Map Radio Network. Here's Tony D and Ron Culver.
All right, and welcome back. It's Wake Up Call Sports Map Radio. On your Monday, you know what? You and I were talking about this. So we're doing NFL previews. And
yes.
We do a division every a week leading up to the season. And it just like kind of dawned on us that this is the start of the eight-week countdown. I was like, oh, yeah, that's right. Here we are on July 11th. Feels like we're a ways away, but, you know, 2 months. And then the NFL season will have its opening week. You'll have the Labor Day with the college football weekend, and then leading up to Thursday's kickoff into the regular season. So it's not that far. My wife and I were running errands this weekend. And I know you probably felt the same way in Houston. At one moment, we were walking from one store to the other, and she just says, "I can't wait for fall." But she wasn't talking about football. She was talking about like maybe wearing a hoodie or maybe like a light jacket. It was scorching hot this weekend.
It was disgusting.
Scorching hot.
Absolutely disgusting. We were driving. We were out at a baseball field all weekend, but we had a break in between games. We're driving. I can't remember where we were driving back to the field. Went to go grab a bite to eat. And there was trees all along the road, and it looked like the leaves were changing colors.
Ah.
And all I can think about is, like, I think those are trees that are just giving up.
Just giving up, yeah. Just
because it's way too early for fall, obviously. But, you know, you're looking at it, and you're like, God, I can't wait. I can't wait to just be able to be outside and not burn up.
I know. We got a little bit of rain, but it's so
little
hot, and it's little, and it's just the sun just beats down. And yeah, and that's one of the that is one of the joys about being a sports fan, especially like for me. I love the Burrs. I love the Burrs seasons, not just for football, but the change of the weather and the holidays. I like going from Halloween to Thanksgiving to Christmas. So I love the Burr months, if you will. But I always love the fact that here in the sports calendar, we have these ebb and flows. And when you catch a wave, it's a great wave. Like when you catch that football fever, when it's like it's late August, we have preseason games, but college football is kind of starting up with week zero and those Thursday night games. And then you realize you're on this ride for the next couple of months. It's going to be a weekly occurrence every single month. And for a lot of people, a lot of it kind of starts that initial feeling, not the full blown feeling, but we'll be starting this week, next week, and the week after with media days in college sports. SEC media days is going on next week in Atlanta. You've got Big 12 media days that are going on this week at AT&T Stadium in Dallas. And then you've got Big 10 media days, which will be on a Tuesday and a Wednesday of the like 26th and 27th. And it's that opening feeling of, yeah, because every coach will say the cliched stuff about how we're going to win and everything's going to be great and we're really looking forward to the season and we don't think anybody's going to outwork us and blah, 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 blah. But in the end, it's the fan base is starting to realize, all right, this and also this means camp's going to start and season is going to get underway pretty soon. And that's a pretty good feeling. I think these media days are a little overblown, to be honest with you. And to be honest, I'm giving you a little bit of inside baseball. It's not something most of you can't figure out. But the idea of going to an event to cover it, to being at an event, always felt like there was that you had to do that. Then COVID hit and people started to realize, yeah, you could do pretty much a good enough job on virtual stuff. Like you can just kind of tune in virtually and still get what you need. Reporters still like one-on-ones, though. They still love to pull a guy and get a personal one-on-one to ask something that maybe they don't want to address in a press conference because they're working on a special story that just requires a few more answers and a few more details. But they're sort of overblown because everybody goes to these things and everybody wants to, it's like a see-to-be-seen kind of thing. But the reality of it is that these college conferences have capitalized on this big time. That SEC Media Day used to be in Hoover, Alabama. It used to be near Birmingham. They've now moved it to Atlanta. they're taking it on an even bigger stage than Birmingham. It's becoming this thing above itself, right? It used to just be a collection of journalists just getting the lowdown on what the season may be like for players and coaches, and now it has turned into like what Super Bowl Media Day has become in a way. Remember when Super Bowl Media Day, if you could talk to old school reporters who used to cover the Super Bowl, there was like a handful of guys around Joe Namath when he made that comment about guaranteeing that we're going to win. It wasn't like there was 500 credentialed media around him. They were all near a pool at a Miami hotel when he made that statement. And oh, by the way, as I'm saying that, Joe Namath is on my television right now pitching some Medicare payment plan product to the senior citizens of America. But that's how it was at Super Bowl III. Now what happens? Now what happens when you go to Super Bowl Media Day, right? You've got Nickelodeon there. You've got a woman in a bridal gown trying to get Tom Brady to marry her. You've got circus clowns. There's all sorts of goofy, silly, I'm going to make a scene. I'm going to make news, or I'm going to do something while I'm here. And some of these college media days, it's not quite that outlandish, but in a lot of these, it can be less business than it is, you know, more, hey, let's go there as part of your C to B scene kind of thing. But that's what's going to be happening later on this month too, is the college coaches will be getting around and getting you all fired up for the season. So we're going to do NFC East this week. So we'll have Dallas and Philadelphia working on Commanders today. If not, we'll start it tomorrow. So NFL season is right around the corner.
Just doesn't feel time yet.
No, it because it's 5,000 degrees in most parts of America.
Yeah, but I mean,
is that it?
You know, but I mean, that's, you know, you always hear about that with like all the way down to the high school level.
Yeah,
of it being too hot to practice.
Yeah,
Yeah, here we are. I mean, you know, we used to have teams like I don't know if are the Cowboys leaving their facilities again, heading for Oxnard.
In a couple of weeks. Yeah,
I mean, they do that. I mean, I know the Houston Texans stopped doing it.
Now, the Houston Texans were...
They used to go to West Virginia.
They used to go to West Virginia to the Greenbrier. The Saints did that, too. The Saints went to the Greenbrier once. Yeah, that's always... That's an attractive place to go. That's in the mountains. Very cool.
Yeah.
Very nice resort. Got good facilities. They've actually made good facilities for a team in a very warm weather place. But now a lot of these teams, they used to be a camaraderie feeling to it, right? My first training camp I ever covered was I went down to Smith College in Rhode Island where the Patriots practiced. And so we would drive down there. And then, of course, when I went to Denver, they were in Greeley, which was north of Denver. So the Broncos used to practice at Northern Colorado at Greeley. But a lot of it was because the guys are going to be in dorms and it's going to be a really controlled environment. And this is training camp, you know, but then a lot more teams are like, no, let's put this in our place. Let's let the guys go home to their houses or condos or wherever they're living. Let them go do that and come back to work. And we don't necessarily have to do this in a college campus in the dorms. Some teams still do it. I think the Steelers still go to St. Vincent College in Latrobe, but most of the NFL teams are within their own sort of organization. Now, the Falcons practice at Flowery Branch, you know, and I think the Saints practice in Metairie. I think their complex is in Metairie. But yeah, but sometimes you get these cool things where you get to go to a nice little cooler climate to work out. Because why would you want to be in stifling heat and humidity in August to work out? Denver was always great. I used to love going to Bronco. It would be a nice like 81 degrees outside, nice breeze, never too boiling. Every now and then you get a day in the 90s where it was really hot, but for the most part it was very comfortable. Not a lot of humidity. I understand why Dallas is brilliant, by the way. That Oxnard, California thing was absolutely brilliant.
Yeah.
Because they went there, it's cooler temperatures, but that's how smart they are. They expand their brand. You know what I mean? You get people out there like, hey, Cowboys practice here. Expand your brand. Take it. You know, Cowboys have got a large footprint around. They could probably get a spot at almost well, a bunch of states around the country to be like, let's go. Like, hey, Cowboys want to go to Montana to work out and would draw a crowd. You know, so that, you know, that I totally absolutely understand why they do that. But yeah, it should be very lean. It should be. I am so looking forward to this season. We did this last week. 10 new head coaches, the loaded AFC. You got to be careful in the AFC. Like, even if your team is decent, like and is expected to have a good year, you still might not make the playoffs. You know, a friend of mine who is back in Denver, he made the statement. He goes, the Broncos will win the AFC West. Just got a little buzz on Twitter. But I'm like, what a bold statement to make about a loaded division. Like even they could go 10-7. They could go 12-5. They could go, who knows what that division is the least wide open division in sports. In the NFL, I mean. Like, you could pick any one of those teams. Somebody has a bad year. Somebody has a bad game. That could be tight all the way through with those four teams. But you got to be careful. Like, even if you're the Cincinnati Bengals or the Tennessee Titans, be careful. You got to win that division. Why would you want to be in a three-team scrub with a bunch of quality football teams out there? There might be three teams out of the East and the AFC East that can make the playoffs if the Dolphins get something going with their weapons offensively. You've got three teams in the North that should make the playoffs, make a run in the playoffs if Deshaun Watson plays and sees action. They could make a run towards the playoffs. The Steelers might not go away. They might be a thorn in the side of anybody trying to win that division. I mean, they're not. I don't think they're going to be 3-14. The AFC South, you've got Indianapolis with Matt Ryan and Tennessee. I don't think the other two teams will be in the mix. But then in the West, you've got all four teams available. If you don't win your division in the AFC, I wouldn't hold my breath, right? I'd be really, really cautious. So I'm very much looking forward to seeing how that conference shapes up. The NFC, I think to me, the NFC is more about the old school teams that are just consistently there. Can they keep it up? Aaron Rodgers, Tom Brady, Dak Prescott, Super Bowl champion Rams. You know, it's less to me about an Eagles, a possible, you know, Arizona Cardinals or anybody else. It's New Orleans. It is, to me, it's mostly about the teams in the top and how good they look or how well they're playing, et cetera. But we also got our good, you know, we also got a Dan Campbell. So we always want to watch him in Detroit because he's one of our favorite coaches in the NFL.
And I hope he turns them around this year.
And I hope I hope the Lions fans feel like they see a lot of growth and they go, we're building something. This
is great. They just feel like, you know, there's hope. There's a light at the end of this tunnel.
Yeah. Somebody said the coach on the Vegas hottest seat in terms of the betting to be the first coach fired is Dan Campbell. I don't think that's true. I think they're going to hang with him for a while. I think they know and he knows the long play of this, what they're trying to do. Coach stability is a key. You want to build a team, coach stability. That team plays hard for this guy, and even though they didn't win a lot of games, is there win more games? If you get a coach that players like to play for, keep him around and see what he does with the talent you're building. They haven't got there quite yet. On Twitter, at Tony D Radio, at Ron Culver. That's Ron with two N's. It's Wake Up Call, Sports Map Radio.
You're listening to Wake Up Call on the Sports Map Radio Network. Alongside Ron Culver, here's Tony D.
On Twitter, at Tony D Radio, at Ron Culver. That's Ron with two N's. Oh, by the way, speaking of Twitter, is Elon Musk going to buy this thing or not? What's the deal? He's pulling out of the deal? Yeah. Why do we go through that song and dance to begin with?
Because it's Elon Musk.
That's why I'm not a big multi-billionaire tech mogul. I know none of this kind of stuff. Like, one day, I thought he had owned it already.
So did I. like proposing changes. Like, yeah. Oh, I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. Like,
I wasn't following it all that closely, but I had at one moment I thought he already did. Because I would see people joke on Twitter like, hey, Elon, can you add this to? I assumed he just owned it already. Apparently he wants to back out of the deal. I don't know.
Yeah, when he said, I'll pony up the $45 billion or whatever it was, I just thought that was like Twitter would be like, yeah, okay.
And everybody who had shares in it was like, yeah, whoa, all right, that's a lot of money for these shares.
Don't have to work no more.
Right. And they were now they don't get it for that amount of money. It's just he can just pull out like that. He can just tease and then go, eh, I'll change my mind.
Imagine being that wealthy that you can just flirt around like, I'm just going to buy it.
Yeah.
Why not?
What a different world. What a weird world that must be.
I mean, is that like the equivalent of us saying choosing whether or not to buy a pack of gum?
I guess. Well,
maybe a new TV.
Yeah, because buying a pack of gum, you just buy a pack of gum. Like
that's him buying a car.
He's yapping with 100 different people, and people are telling him what it's worth. Because the thing about it is, when you're that wealthy, every economic decision you make shakes the world, right? Like every major decision. Like, okay, now this is so you have to be, I guess, kind of careful what kind of things you're purchasing. I think it would be wild, though, to be like he's relatively young, right? 50?
I think so, yeah.
51 years old? I mean, he's relatively young, and he's got like he's probably the most powerful person in the world, given the way he can shape markets and shape currency and things like that. But it's just funny. I bring out our Twitter handle, and then I realize I don't even know who owns it anymore. Like, I thought I did, and this is why I'm not a multi-tech billionaire who messes around with $44 a share for a company don't know much about.